evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, June 24, 2019. Ethiopian police kill a suspected coup leader after the National Army Chief was gunned down in Addis Ababa.
He was arrested for a coup attempt. He was among the people who was released after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power. And after he was released, he was appointed as chief security head of the Amhara region.
And the WFP distributes food to vulnerable South Sudanese.
For many people who have been affected by the conflict and due to the longer-term effects of the conflict, as well as years of stagnation in the economy.
We'll bring details on these stories after a short while. Ethiopian Regional Security Chief Semwe Tesgay, the suspected ringleader of Saturday's failed coup attempt in Ethiopia, has been killed. Six people, including a bodyguard who killed the army chief, are now known to have died in the unrest. Flags are flying at half-mast after the federal government declared a day of mourning to mark the deaths. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has urged Ethiopians to unite against what he calls evil forces set on dividing the country. Both the army chief, General Sare Mekonnen, and Amhara regional governor, Abechu Mekonnen, who was also killed, were seen as close allies of the prime minister. A heavy contingent of pro-government forces has been deployed in the Amhara's capital, Bahardar, and the federal capital, Addis Ababa. The internet has been shut down across the country. VOA's Horn of Africa Service managing editor, Tezita Bilecho, provides some insights into the looming crisis in Ethiopia.
The perpetrator of the coup, Brigadier General Asamineu Tsege, is killed. He was trying to escape, but he was killed in Bahardar, in the regional capital of the Amhara region.
And who is this Brigadier General? Could you tell us a little bit about him? Who is he?
Well, he is significant because during the previous administration, headed by, you know, supposedly quote-unquote TPLF, Tigray Liberation Front, he was arrested for a coup attempt. He was jailed for several years and also tortured. He was among the people who was released after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power under the current reform. And after he was released, he was appointed as chief security head of the Amhara region. But in that position, he's been unhappy with the reform. There are a couple of things. He felt the Amhara people are not getting the proportion of power they deserve. And the other thing is he kept complaining that the Amhara region is surrounded by enemies. And he is referring to the officials in Tigray region. The person who allegedly tortured him and jailed him now is a security chief in the Tigray region, Getachew Assefa. As you know, he is wanted by the federal government also. But the regional government does not want to turn him over to the federal government.
If somebody is needed by a national government, why would the regional government not turn over that person? It sounds a little bit weird.
I do not have the answer for that. Only Tigray regional government can respond to that. But, you know, everything in Ethiopia nowadays is along, you know, you support whoever belongs to your ethnic.
So it's an ethnicized politics.
It isn't it?
Let's look at it this way, that the attempted coup in the Amhara region, if it was successful, would the national government accept that?
No, because Dr. Ambachew Mekonnen, who was killed by this attempt, he was a moderate. He was trying to bring reform to the country by, you know, negotiating with all other parties. Mind you, there are, you know, four major parties in EPRDF. the Amhara Democratic Party, Oromo Democratic Party, the TPLF, Tigray Liberation Front, and also the Southern Ethiopia Party. So Dr. Ambacho is very moderate. He believed in negotiation. He believed in discussion. When this general, Asamino, he was repeatedly complaining about what he called a threat from Tigray region, because the two regions, the Amhara region and the Tigray region, are claiming territory. Dr. Ambacho, who is now deceased, the regional president, believed in discussing issues with the people of Tigray region. Mm-hmm. He kept saying, you know, we will have to negotiate. We are brotherly people, you know.
And what is the connection between what happened in the Amhara region and the assassination of the head of the military in Addis Ababa?
That is not clear, because the head of the military was assassinated along with another retired general by their bodyguard, sitting in his home. It's not simultaneous. It's presumed connected, because the head of the security chief would stop the coup attempt. That's the assumption. But I do not have a clear answer
in
that.
Let's look at it from this angle. It looks like the people who have been killed in this Amhara region are all people appointed by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
Is this an attempt to fight back the reforms that Prime Minister Abiy is spearheading in Ethiopia?
Not necessarily. There are multiple angles. There are elements in Ethiopia who do not like the reform, who reject the reform. That's not Brigadier General Asamino Zage. His objection is the way the reform is conducted. The power struggle with TPLF and the central government, and also the territorial question that he's claiming, Walkait and Raya, all these, the Amharas claim it, and the Tigrayans also claim it.
That's Tazeta Bilachwe, managing editor of VOA's Horn of Africa service, speaking with me here in our studio earlier today. The UN's World Food Programme says it is trying to reach 5.4 million food-insecure South Sudanese. 9 months since the country signed the revitalized peace deal, millions of South Sudanese across several parts of the country continue to rely on food aid. Wake Simon Wudu recently traveled to Malakal to witness WFP's food distribution in that area.
Thousands of internally displaced persons queued up to receive relief food delivered from the World Food Program at the UN-run Protection of Civilians site in Malakal. Emmanuel Tifo, a father of 13 children, holds 2 bars of soap he received at WFP Distribution Center and looks unhappy. Tifo says his wife and children moved to the POC site in 2015 when he could no longer bear the insecurity in his village of Panyikang. But over the past few years, he has been too afraid to leave the UN-run camp due to insecurity.
It is a life sacrifice. If the security is not fine, it is a sacrifice, and if you don't sacrifice to search food for your children, you cannot survive. All we do is we go out fishing as a group. Going out of the POC camp in search of food is a life sacrifice.
30-year-old Regina Monyibonyo says she has lived for nearly 5 years in the UN-run camp after she fled, fighting in her home village of Melut.
Life is hard. It is the UN that is helping us. The cereal that is being given to us by the UN is the food we are surviving on. Or sometimes we could go and hunt for wild fruits. They will be the one to help us.
Mondena Sela, a World Vision official in Malakal, says the food rations that humanitarian agencies provide to IDPs is calculated by nutritionists who know the energy requirements for the IDPs to survive.
The beneficiaries do not understand those aspects of calories. Sometimes they may prepare more, they may share, sometimes they want to use it for other things. So that in itself, yes, may not be enough. But at the end of the day, we keep on advising and informing them what this food is meant to for.
At least 30,000 IDPs shelter at the UN camp in Malakal, all of whom survive on food aid. Thompson Fiery, the World Food Programme Communications Officer for South Sudan, says the humanitarian support the IDPs receive is life-saving.
For many people who have been affected by the conflict and due to the longer-term effects of the conflict, as well as years of stagnation in the economy.
2 weeks ago, the South Sudan government and three UN agencies released a report indicating that nearly 7 million people, or 61% of the country's population, are food insecure. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
European Union Commission last week announced a 48.5 million euros donation to humanitarian assistance in South Sudan. Lasuba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
Senate Wells, the EU ambassador to South Sudan, says the 48.5 million euros will be used in four key areas, including providing emergency food assistance to the starving population.
One is about protection of vulnerable populations, like people with disabilities, for example. One is about emergency food assistance. So, for example, we are providing 4 million euros to UNICEF to tackle severe acute malnutrition, which often affects children.
Three UN agencies, WFP, FAO, and UNICEF, said a week ago that more than 6 million South Sudanese are facing severe hunger in most parts of the country. Ambassador Wells says the European Union wants to invest in long-term development projects, but despite the peace agreement, the needs of the population remain dire.
Despite the peace agreement, which we welcome very warmly, humanitarian needs are still very great, and they will be very great for the foreseeable future. So we can't, you know, completely shift over to development assistance and leave these populations vulnerable.
Steve Omley, head of UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan, said, quote, "We are extremely happy that the EU has released additional funding to South Sudan at this critical time," end quote. Manasseh Lomole is the chairperson of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission.
The money has come at the right time so that the needs of the people can be met, the basic needs of our people can be met. But what our people need most is really a support that will enable them to be able to produce for themselves. In other words, they need the means of production other than being given.
Some South Sudanese residents in the capital Juba have welcomed the EU donation. Betty Ange, a 36-year-old mother of four whose husband was killed in 2014 during the war, says he hopes the funds will be used for the intended purpose.
We are really suffering here in South Sudan, especially we who lost our husbands. If this assistance comes, even though we are given small, it will help our children, especially I, who lost my husband during the war.
Konga Diet Kwong is an internally displaced person living in a UN-run protection of civilian site in Juba.
There is those in FOC who have been affected by war, actually, and there is some children who are not been in schoolings. So we need those funding to construct the school, and supporting those of POC also. There is some lack of medicines in POC.
Ambassador Wells stresses that the EU is focused on helping the millions of South Sudanese affected by the conflict. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the scorecard of the revitalized peace deal. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe that music can play a role in healing ailments? Why or why not?
It can help to heal. because the words that songs can give meaning to them. To the other people who don't feel anything, who lost sense of humanity, it cannot even mean anything, even if you sing for the last 100 years.
Music plays a big role in that. People believe in this sort of having favorite music. So sometimes when you're depressed or you're frustrated, it takes you to that special song. And when you listen to it, it just melts you down.
Music speaks directly to the soul. You hear music's playing, you're still checking, even if you don't know the language of which that person is singing in. So I believe music can heal certain things.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United States Institute of Peace held a discussion on the future of South Sudan last week. Susan Stegand is the Director for Africa Programs and moderated discussions on the scorecard of the South Sudan's revitalized peace deal. In part one of our 5 series on South Sudan's future, the panelists discuss the potential threats facing South Sudan's road to peace.
We hear two narratives about the peace agreement. One narrative that says, this is an agreement, key people have signed, it helps to end the violence, and people should make use of that space to try to get the country back on a path towards peace. That it creates a little bit of a moment for those who are pushing for peace to make some traction. We hear another narrative that is maybe a luxury of a narrative here in Washington, that this agreement was never going to make things better in the country, fundamentally. That these arrangements have been tried before, and they have failed not once, but twice. And so why would we think that they would hold, much less put the country on a path towards transformation and fundamentally changing and improving the lives of South Sudanese? And so today we're not going to try to judge which one is the right narrative or the wrong narrative, but just to acknowledge that there are different views about the path forward for the country of South Sudan, and to try to think through how can we motivate, mobilize, and animate this stalled peace process. So I now have the pleasure of introducing our panelists today, David Achwath, who's the founder of the Council on South Sudanese-American Relations, and who has been leading an initiative with South Sudanese diaspora on dialogue. Morgan Simpson, who is the Deputy Director of Democracy International, Brian Adeba, who is the Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project, and Mark Ferrello, who's the Senior Advisor at the Sentry Project. We're also joined by Dr. Emily Koyiti, who participated in the negotiations of the revitalized agreement, and she also served on JMEC during the implementation of the original agreement. So I'm going to open it up to our panel. We'll have a bit of a conversation, and then we look forward to engaging all of you in the discussion. Last week, the United Nations issued a report on the humanitarian situation in the country and indicated that 60% of the population, 7 million people, don't consistently have food to feed themselves. So this is one marker of what's happening in the country, but what is the overall feeling in South Sudan? And maybe I'll turn to Brian to start us off.
I think there is some optimism about the peace agreement in that the level of violence has subsided and the cessation of hostilities agreement seems to be holding. However, there are many other concerns. Freedom of association is still an issue. Infringement on liberties in South Sudan by authorities and security agencies is still an issue of concern. But more importantly is the increase in cattle rustling. And that's the next security threat for South Sudan. And the policymakers that are currently looking at drafting a new defense policy and all that have to look at that and identify it as a source of threat to the security of the country and has to be countered. The problem with cattle rustling and its increase is the fact that it's being militarized at this particular point. It involves communities and it transcends the old ways of how it was carried out, and that right now the actors in it have sophisticated weapons, and there is evidence to suggest the involvement of politicians in the cattle rustling. So those are some of the key issues coming up.
David, does that match with what you hear as you talk to folks who are in South Sudan and to South Sudanese who are watching what's happening in South Sudan from the United States?
Thank you, Susan. I think I agree with the Brian's assessment of the situation. But I would just add that one of the, beneath the surface of the idea that there is no conflict in South Sudan, the violence has resided in Juba right now, that message has actually gone to refugees camp, and you have a great number of people from the camps running back to Juba and South and other cities in South Sudan. And what I'm hearing from the ground is that that has created an economic problem because there is no enough food for people to eat. And that actually led to so many young children on the street begging and actually stealing. So at the same time, in the absence of, hearing the voice, the sound of guns in the city, there is continuing crisis beneath the surface that is related to economic and food shortages.
Dr. Emily, do you have any insights in terms of how people inside of South Sudan are seeing the situation right now?
Thank you, Susan. Okay. The feeling on the ground from most of the people is that, yes, indeed, there is reduced violence, but there are other fears that are not necessarily related to the agreement per se. We have the rains that are on, and of course, there is impending famine with many lacking food and basics. Much as people are returning from the refugee camps, they are not well aware of the challenges they could possibly face when they get back home. And when they arrive, then they realize that, oh, this is what we are facing. And then they arrive to places which do not necessarily have all the necessities for living a dignified life. We still have places in Upper Nile, even in the Equatorias, that are civilian-owned ordinarily, but are still occupied by the different armed groups. The report from CITISAM and the CDC was already showing that the government side itself still occupies a good number of civilian buildings. And with that going on, those are fears related to the agreement, and also some that I've highlighted that are not necessarily related to the situation of conflict. But generally, there has been reduced fighting between the parties, and that's a good sign.
Thanks, Dr. Emily. I was looking back at an event we did almost 2 years ago with some South Sudanese activists, and someone then had said, "You can't have dialogue when the guns are still singing." And certainly reducing some of the level of violence because of the political conflict is progress, but the obstacles that remain are really significant. Morgan, you travel back and forth between the United States and Juba. From the perspective of an organization that's implementing programming to support civil society, how do you see the situation in the country?
Thank you. My colleagues have it exactly right. People are excited that it seems that violence has reduced. The economic situation, however, continues to pose serious problems for everyday life. And local level conflicts still continue to be an issue. In terms of the peace agreement, I think there's sort of a general sense that extending the pre-transitional period was the right decision. But our partners are watching very closely to see that there's actually a concrete plan in place to make sure that the steps that weren't completed during the first part of the pre-transitional period are actually completed this time. We've seen more movement in the agreement's implementation as compared to 2015, but some of the hardest things to implement in terms of security sector reform, creating the boundaries for the states, those things still haven't been implemented, and our partners definitely want to see movement on those issues in the next few months.
So let's turn to that a little bit in terms of the peace agreement itself. As you noted, the pre-transition period has been extended for another 6 months. The full term of the agreement remains the same. And I believe that JMEC indicated that about 44% of the agreement had been implemented as people went into these negotiations. So I'm curious, from this program that's being supported by the Voluntary Civil Society Task Force on the implementation of the peace agreement under the Peace Implementation Monitoring Initiative, so that's a mouthful.
It's PIMI, P-I-M-I, and we can refer people to the website if they're interested in reading the details of the report, but interested to hear a little bit more about how your partners are seeing the status of implementation, where are areas of progress, what are core gaps, and what are some of the fundamental barriers to making progress?
I think, so as compared in particular to the 2015 agreement, as I said, the task force, the PIMI group, began their work under that agreement, monitoring its implementation and really the lack thereof, and calling out sort of the failures to implement it. And sort of as a result of that, they have become very, very much engaged in the whole revitalization process. And now the implementation of the revitalized agreement, I think we've seen a lot more civil society engagement in the process this time around, including there's a lot better representation of civil society, of academia, of women on the committees formed under the revitalized agreement, which is significant progress in their view and in our view. In terms of the barriers, like I said, the main things are the security sector reform, the the cantonment sites, the deoccupation, as Emily pointed out, of soldiers in civilian spaces. Those are sort of some of the priority issues, and the formation of states. I think that's one of the most controversial issues, and it's going to be very difficult for that to go through smoothly, but it needs to happen in order to be able to move forward with forming a government. I think the other thing that's particularly important is implementation of Chapter 5 in terms of the transitional justice mechanisms. That's a chapter that sees particular resistance to implementation because of its emphasis on accountability. But I think there are ways, particularly through civil society, to move forward with certain elements of it, in particular the CTRH, the Commission on Truth, Reconciliation, and Healing, moving forward with reconciling among the population of building a sense of nationhood beyond tribal lines that would at least help move forward in the transitional justice process without maybe immediately going to the hybrid court, which is definitely going to be difficult.
Dr. Emily, you've observed and been involved in JMEC. Do you have any reflections on what some of the fundamental barriers are to going forward, and where would you see the scorecard right now of where we stand?
I can't give a very clear projection of what the scorecard is right now, but the situation, to me, it still doesn't give much hope, given the time we are left with and we had to extend for 6 months. The barriers that we have at the moment is that there is the NPTC is supposed to provide resources for a lot of work to be done during the pre-transitional period. And what we are seeing is that very little has been remitted for activities to be done. Until now, the report we got today is that cantonment sites do not have the basics. They do not have water. They do not have food. And those are things that the soldiers will be cantoned with need. And then one thing that people also don't talk about among us, the things that are really prerequisites before we think about November being possible for us to form a revitalized transition government of national unity, is the fact that there is supposed to be some legislative reforms that are at the moment being undertaken, spearheaded by the National Constitutional Amendment Committee. But what we are seeing is that the amendment bill, for example, has been sent back. There is contention about some issues on the National Security Service Bill. And all these are very important for securing the space that is required for a revitalized transitional government of national unity to thrive, and then for parties to be able to implement an agreement in an environment that is conducive.
Those are panelists. Emily Koiti is a civil society activist. Morgan Simpson, Deputy Director for Democracy International. Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the ENAF Project. And David Chad, Founder of the Council on South Sudan American Relations. In part two of this discussion tomorrow, panelists will talk about security sector reform as a primary requirement for peace in South Sudan. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Bin Cholera by Ben and Shaba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
know I wanna stay. I swear I never wanna live without you. Mutima wanje waujanye, waujanye utazaugarura. Mama darling, I take you Mumbai. Mama darling, I promise to never go. Again that again now, but all I know she cannot do blanda. She makes me surrender, but everybody tell me no wonder. Again that again now.